Hi, listeners. This is Dan. Before we begin today's show, I need to mention that the Project Fibonacci Foundation, which supports this podcast, hosts year-round STEAM education events for students in the K-12 and college levels, educators, and community members. We have some upcoming events that we want you to know about, like the Livestream series. Livestream is a unique professional development series for STEM educators and school counselors, proponents of STEM with the arts, or STEAM, industry professionals, and business and community leaders. The purpose of this series is to enhance the awareness and educational preparation of the students in the region for careers resulting from cutting-edge scientific research and technologies. Educators can earn professional development credits for attending through their affiliated BOCES and learning lessons and workshop ideas to bring back to their classrooms to further motivate and enlighten their students. In our next Livestream segment called Discovery, Learning, and the Future will be in May 2019. On March 28th, 2018, so coming up pretty soon, the Project Fibonacci Foundation is partnering with Utica College to present a day focused on women's leadership in STEAM fields. This day-long event will feature workshops, roundtables, and keynotes from leaders in education, entrepreneurship, women's issues, and STEAM. It's going to be on Thursday, March 28th at Utica College in the Library Concourse. Go to projectfibonacci.org for more information about the Women and STEAM Congress. And one last upcoming event that you should know about, the Project Fibonacci STEAM Leadership Conference. Since 2016, the Project Fibonacci Foundation has held a week-long summer STEAM Leadership Conference, which has been attended by over 300 high school and college students from around the country and specifically focused in New York State. Each year, the conference steering committee, consisting of over 30 business leaders, educators, artists, and community members, develops a highly interactive curriculum for our STEAM scholars. Participants are exposed to in-depth STEAM content, cutting-edge innovations, and encouraged to reach further in their academic and career pursuits. This year, their team-based and project-based focus is a Mars colony. So if you have someone in your life, a young person who would be interested and get something out of this, please go download the nomination form on projectfibonacci.org. And now, let's start the show.
But I get a lot of people asking, like, hey, what is the scientific method? And, you know, and how does that relate to engineering and those things? Well, I think really science is just idea, try it, and adjust.
Welcome to STEAMcast, where STEM and the arts collide. I'm your host, Dan Kostelik, and together we're going to have conversations with the brightest lights and rising stars in the fields of science, technology, engineering, the arts, and math, exploring the world that we live in, the science that makes it all possible, and the art that makes it interesting. This is episode 8, and I'm joined once again by research scientists Dr. Bryant Wysocki and Nathan McDonald, talking about the concept of what is science. Our conversation goes a little bit all over the map, and I think it's a really good journey that we get to go on together.
Nathan and I go around the country. We do a lot of lectures or STEM events, and it's probably one of the most fun things I think we get to do. And we have a pretty good rapport. We pick on each other during these things, but I get a lot of people asking, like, hey, what is the scientific method? And, you know, and how does that relate to engineering and those things? Well, I think really science is just idea, try it, and adjust. I mean, I think it's really that simple. You have an idea. Is that stove hot? You touch it. Yes, it is. And you adjust your worldview or your model. Now, you get into all those other things, right? So the idea can be anything. It can be complex. You can try to explain something that you've observed. You want to try something new, or maybe you want to validate someone else's idea or some established convention. And then you try it. You basically test your ideas, your hypothesis. But here now you use rigorous design of experiments, metrics. These are things that you're taught. And then at the end, you adjust or adapt your world model, your equation, or your view to incorporate your new findings. That's pretty much it. You just have an idea, you try it out, and you adjust accordingly. And so when it gets to the education that we were talking about, right, I think education simply teaches you how to learn and solve technical problems. But It's more about how to learn. And you're going to, if you go into a science and engineering career field, and we haven't even brought in the arts yet, and I love the way that science and engineering adds depth to the beauty and the aesthetics of arts and things. So without going too deep that way, I think basically education just teaches you how to learn. And then if you're going to be a scientist or engineer, you better be like learning, because you're going to have to do it for the rest of your
lifetime
life,
learner.
Especially now that technology is changing so fast. The poor person that learned to program in COBOL or something, you know, probably had to learn three different languages after that. So you have to like to learn. But I think we all do. I think we're all engineers and scientists. I think Einstein said that play is the best form of research, or the highest form of research is probably more accurate. So Feynman is a, I'm a big fan of Richard Feynman, a physicist that everyone
Nobel
is probably
laureate.
For, yes, Nobel for his work on quantum electrodynamics. But he has a great saying, and I even wrote it down because I like to butcher quotes. but it's, he states that you can know the name of a bird in all the languages of the world, but when you're finished, you'll know absolutely nothing whatsoever about the bird. So let's look at the bird and let's see what it's doing. That's what counts. And that's Richard P. Feynman. And I think that really is all science is poking things with a stick and seeing what happens, as Nathan likes to put it. And do you have any comments on that, Nathan? Because really, for me, science has opened up an adventure. It's not just equations and lab books, and it has allowed me to launch vehicles in this space, to work with satellites and things, as I mentioned before, to work with high-power lasers, to understand the workings of the atomic bomb. And so that's where Nathan's and I mutual passion for this comes out. Do you have anything?
No, I mean, really, just to continue what Brian's saying, absolutely fascinating. There has to be a better term for this, but professional curiouser. Just find absolutely everything. There is nothing that is not interesting about something if you look at it hard enough. You know, it's finding what's the right question. And I think that's a lot of a good education. What are the right questions to ask about this topic? And that framework, you know, being a professional scientist, that's a worldview. It's a framework how you approach the world. And it applies for more than just science, as we were talking with Bryant. Apply that to politics, apply that to economics. One of the interesting things with science in how they set up this idea, try and adapt your model, is you have to have a falsifiable hypothesis. You have to be able to prove your idea wrong.
You have to be willing to let that happen.
And that most people, if you don't explicitly think about that, then you'll come up with an idea. I did an experiment, but you didn't set up an experiment that could prove your idea wrong. And talking with people about different ideas, especially when it's not science, economics, politics, etc., well, what is your hypothesis and what is your experiment, and are you capable of changing your mind? And once you are trained or used to thinking about things in that way, suddenly we can have a useful dialogue. I can come up with an interesting experiment. I can get useful data. Just throwing data at people really doesn't change anyone's mind. It just gives them lots of facts that they can cherry pick to decide what they decide is going to fit their idea.
That's why young scientists are typically the best scientists, because they haven't formed those biases yet and they're open to all those new ideas. I mean, you really need to strive to be unbiased and have the ability to discard any of your previous beliefs, theories, or ideas. And you do this so unconsciously, right? You pull out data that supports the way you think. We do it all the time. We do it as scientists. And so it's just human nature. And you have to be able to have that discipline to be like, wow, I don't really like where this is going, but this is what the data shows.
So then what's the best age of a scientist? If the young scientist is in some ways the best scientist because they don't have the biases built in yet, but the older
I'm sure there's more reasons too.
Yeah, but energy, correct. And yeah. Excitement and ability to drink 5-hour energy. And then the older scientist, you know, just has years and years and years of just knowledge of institutional know-how. Where's the sweet spot?
I wouldn't say it's
45
I wouldn't say it's an age.
Oh, much younger.
It's a worldview.
Okay.
I would focus on you have to be curious. You have to be willing to accept that you could be wrong. Because children are naturally curious. They want to know about things. They don't know things, so they want to know about things. And it's learning, making that a habit. In standard education, once you're an adult, well, I'm still alive. My idea of how the world works must be good. I haven't died yet. And so it's very easy to say, I've done learning. And I'll only learn information that supports what I already think. Whereas a scientist, and this is, or I'm just repeating myself now, as a scientist, I'm always open. I'm explicitly cognizant of the fact that I could be wrong.
So if you're a closed-minded scientist, basically is there an organization or could another scientist come and take away your science card?
No, but there was a great book, Thomas Kuntz, I think it is, The Nature of Scientific Revolution, and he commented that in the great scientific revolutions, at some point there are scientists that will never change their mind because they've built their entire lives on a particular framework and will accept no different. And really what everyone does is wait for them to die, and all the younger scientists,
you find that,
have figured out which theory they like best, and that's the one that continues.
You find that in a lot of other areas as well, of just, oh, we just need them to die off and go away.
Unfortunately.
You see it in the arts a lot, too.
I think a lot of scientists, if you look at the Nobel laureates across history, most of them did their best work in their early 20s. And you can argue mm-hmm. that and debate it. But I think there is something to say about the energy and the drive and the openness of that age.
So the massive explosive ideas tend to, let's say, come early, and then the refining of it and making it work happens later?
I would say, yeah.
No, I concur.
Because there's, you definitely need the people that, the scientists that will spend 40 years working on this one particular area to get the insight they need to make the great innovation.
Okay.
The guy who developed, I don't remember the last name, the guy who developed the chronometer, which was important for determining longitude in the ocean.
Oh, yeah. They did an entire miniseries back on that in the 90s.
Oh, did they?
Yes. It was called, I think it was just actually called... longitude.
Okay.
Yeah, because the lines of for you, dear listeners, lines of longitude, if you don't know, connect at the poles, so they get wider towards the equators, whereas latitude remains consistent the entire way.
So it's very easy to figure out longitude or latitude where you are, but at longitude, and if you're sailing in a ship, that's kind of important. So the guy who developed this worked by himself for 30 years. Went through, I think, 4 iterations finally. But that was the only thing he worked on for 30, 40 years.
Didn't his son work on that too?
I think, yeah, he did carry on some of the work. And he didn't make any money off of it.
He received a prize from the crown.
He received a prize, but I mean, the Royal Society, I mean, just shafted him, quite frankly. But there is something to be said for the scientists that will spend the years to work through the drudgery to get that insight.
And there's also something to be said because that was in one of the great ages of exploration. That was funded as a prize. Not, I think, if memory serves from this miniseries I saw years ago, I think it was on TNT. If memory serves, King George III himself, who was an amateur scientist, he was I think he called himself a naturalist, he funded the prize himself, I think.
Mm-hmm. And was involved in the actual judging final or at the end.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for a government that supports research and seeing what's next. So there's I think a direct allegory right there, a direct connection to Kennedy in the early 60s saying, we are going to be on the moon by the end of the decade.
Especially basic research takes a long time to develop. I was talking to one of my friends the other day, and we were talking about microelectronic, what is it, MEMS, microelectromechanical devices, something like that. And they were doing with mirrors, and he said it took 17 years from basic research to something you could buy commercially. When we talk about science, I mean, that's science and technology. That's everything from, you know, I poke it with a stick and it moved to I can put it in my iPhone. And you do need a lot of patience to be able to see something through from concept to development. I mean, rail guns. The Navy's been working on the rail guns for how long?
Over 20 years. That was the MacGuffin in the Schwarzenegger movie. with, oh, what was that called?
I don't know.
With Schwarzenegger, Vanessa Williams, and he had a railgun. But it was
apparently.
I was in high school when this came out. Okay. So
it's not a documentary.
No. Okay. Unless it was a dramatized, based on actual events type thing. But so, the railgun, they've been working on it for years.
So one thing I want to add is that when we talk scientists and engineers, and Nathan and I use that term a lot in this particular conversation, we just mean everybody.
Yeah.
In my mind, everyone is a scientist, an engineer, from a baby that throws the spoon off the high chair and realizes that it's gone and starts to comprehend that and build their world view of gravity and things being obstructed by other obstacles and vision.
Or how many times can I drop it before mom and dad will give it to me back again?
And so those things are, I mean, we're all scientists and engineers. I think, and that goes for the physical, society, creativity, imagination, exploration. These are all concepts that a good engineer, scientist, STEAM practitioner should have. I think people sometimes miss the creative nature of it. You are inventing new ideas, new things, objects, capabilities, rocket ships. You get to be very creative.
Combining ideas that nobody ever thought you could combine before and finding out what happens. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating stuff.
So start moving into the lightning round here a little bit. Nathan, you gave a talk to the C-STEP program at SUNY Poly, mm-hmm. At SUNY Polytechnic, a few weeks ago. And you were kind enough to give me your notes. I want to come to a couple points on here. You can't afford to be cynical was one of your notes.
Mm-hmm.
So define it, cynicism versus skepticism.
Cynicism is something is broken and I can't do anything to fix it. And so at some point, I know there's a problem with the system, and I just give up. I don't care anymore. So I'm being realistic. I'm doing air quotes that you can't see.
Okay, yeah.
I heard them. Versus skeptical, which is, you know, just we're going to go to the moon, and, well, okay, that's a great idea, but I just don't see logistically how you're going to be able to do that.
Okay. So we're now talking about going to the moon. Everybody is now making more of a push to go to the moon. NASA's genuinely talking about it. Elon Musk wants to put a Hyperloop on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all of that. 15 years ago, when George W. Bush said, we're going to go to Mars, was that cynicism or skepticism when people were like, okay, yeah, sure. Every public-facing thing, nothing happened.
I would say off the cuff, it'd be a mixture of both.
Okay.
And the reason it'd be a mixture of both is look at what private industry has done in the space race, if you will, in the past 5 years. You could give NASA the same budget, and my cynicism, my skepticism would say NASA wouldn't be able to do the same. And part of that is how government does research versus how private industry does research. So we can talk about science all the time, but mm-hmm. there is a how IBM does their research is different from how NASA does their research versus how a college or university does their research. And that gets more into more philosophy and how do we fund research and things like that. And that gets very nuanced really, really quickly.
Okay.
So because we are seeing progress. We are seeing, I mean, we're relaunching rockets. They're landing on launch pads. No scientist or engineer can't watch that and be like, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing since sliced bread. That's what's going to drive the enthusiasm to say, yeah, it's not just a pipe dream anymore.
Okay. Bryant, you mentioned programming language and people who learned one language years ago have probably learned two, three, or four more languages now. Is the difference in learning a programming language substantially different from learning a standard written or spoken language, or is it roughly the same process?
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that. My personal experience is that it's just taking a language you already know and creating a syntax that the computer can interpret. So it's not to the extent of learning a new language with new symbols potentially and new sounds, right?
Yeah, no really one here is complex.
It's taking a language you already understand and it's turning it into an abbreviated version that's clear and concise so that you can be reproducible, you can be...
So it's more about the transliteration as opposed to the translation.
In my opinion.
have a programmer friend who said the analogy is you're a carpenter. If you can work with oak, you can work with pine. There's some nuances how you work with it, but if you know one, you can figure out the other.
Okay. And so the lightning round of the lightning round, some things that I want to talk about. Please forgive me for any mispronunciations. Ectopic eyeballs on tadpoles?
Ectopic eyeballs on tadpoles.
What's that?
2-minute version. Is the brain USB, or does it look for eye signals coming from the eye socket? And so what scientists did is they took tadpole eyes, they surgically removed them, implanted them on the tail, and let them grow, and did experiments to see if the tadpole could see out of the eye on its tail. Turns out that if the optic nerve could reach the spinal column, it could, which is fascinating.
They start swimming backwards?
I don't know. The paper did not specify. What they were looking for, associating colors with electroshocks. But why that's important, because we don't like hurting animals. That's not the point of science. But what that means is that the eye somehow has a header, if you will, that tells the brain, hey, this is an eye file. Or, you know, this is all the signals in this, they come from an eye. And so the brain processes it like an eye. Well, if you have amputees or people missing eyes and you want to give them artificial stimulation, well, it means you don't have to figure out exactly where in the brain to plug in that information. You could just tap the spinal column anywhere. And as long as you get that header file right or figure out, allow the brain to learn a new header file, unique header file, the brain can figure it out.
So within the next few years, more and more humans as the ultimate computer, heretofore the ultimate machine, were becoming plug and play.
Possibly.
Okay.
I don't want that world at some point, but
I would love, genuinely, I mean, this is me looking on the positive side of technological advances and cybernetics and whatnot. I would love the ability, if my arm is broken, to just get a replacement. I mean, of just, we have replacement, and not, like, taken off of a clone that, like, you're just, we have body farms somewhere,
yeah,
but
yeah,
take your
that.
Own, but more of a Star Trek sense of either here is a perfect cybernetic replacement for yourself, or even we cloned you from your own cells, you're the limb that you lost. I think that would be amazing, and
we shall see.
It would allow me to live forever. epigenetics on worms?
Oh, epigenetics. So you have genetics, and that's more than, genetics covers more than just your eye color and hair color. Those are kind of fixed. However, on a day-to-day basis, your DNA, the environment can affect how the DNA expresses genes. An example that just came out last year, Tufts University. Do you remember those worms in biology class where you could cut them in half, and if you had the half that had the head, it grew the tail, and if you had the part that had the tail, it grew the head?
Yeah.
So if you put them in a liquid medium and you apply a voltage across it, you can cause them to only grow heads or only grow tails. So if you have the head part, it'll grow two heads. Now, that's not very helpful. You got to be able to reverse it. So if you apply a different voltage across the worm, it'll cause it then to go back and only grow heads or tails. So you haven't changed the DNA, but you have sufficiently changed the environment such that the DNA gets expressed differently. And so that is when scientists, they've only recently been learning about this, totally opens up different ways to treat diseases. How many of our diseases are not genetic in your eye color is fixed, but environmental factors?
So like cancers.
Exactly.
So turn off the cancer.
I'm going to be very broad. There are certain classes of cancers where the brain...
All of them are different from each other.
Your body doesn't recognize cancer as cancer. Something's been turned off. And if you can turn it back on, then the brain, or then your white blood cells are suddenly like, oh, shoot, that's cancer, and we can get rid of it. Yeah, so it totally opens up how we how we treat different things.
Oh, that's amazing. We need to do an entire episode on that. Sleeping jellyfish?
Do jellyfish sleep? They don't have brains.
Yeah, I know.
So
they're immortal.
I've heard something about that. So this came out of Caltech a year ago, I think. So the big thing with sleep is that we think, scientists talk about, your brain needs to process long or take short-term memory and put it into long-term memory. well, if jellyfish don't have brains, they can't sleep. So these three friends, they were doing, one was doing research in worms, and the other was doing research in jellyfish, and he commented to the guy who was working on the worms, "I think my jellyfish are sleeping," which doesn't make any sense. And so they go off down to the lab to go do these experiments, and they meet their other friend, and she's like, "Well, what are you guys doing?" "We're testing sleeping jellyfish." And she's like, "That's stupid. I'm going to come along too." So it's just always great when that happens. So how do you show an organism sleeps? So first off, that's really cool. It's kind of fundamental, but I had to sit and think about that. So first off, can you tell the difference between a sleeping jellyfish and an awake jellyfish? Do they do anything different? Jellyfish, the only thing they do to move is pulse what's called their bell, that top part. And so they got a stopwatch, and they just watched them during the day and during the night. And yeah, at night, the jellyfish would pulse its bell about 30% less frequently. So then the next checkbox one. Two, can you wake it from a sleep state? It's not dead. It's not hibernating. It has to be in a state that you can just rouse it. So these are upside down jellyfish. They like to be at the bottom of the tank. If you lift them up and drop them, they kind of spaz out and then swim back down to the bottom. So they timed how long it took if you lift it up and drop it in the tank, how long it took it to recognize it was falling and then swim back down. Then they built a trap door in a container suspended above the tank. They let the jellyfish sleep in that. And then at night, they ripped the bottom out and left it fall and timed how long it took for the jellyfish to realize that it was falling and swim back down. And sure enough, it was slower. It had to rouse from that sleep or from that state of sleep to recognize that it's falling. And then the third is there has to be a result, a negative result due to sleep deprivation. So how do you sleep deprive a jellyfish? They just got a squirt gun and sprayed it every 20 minutes all night. And so the next morning is kind of twitching in the tank, and they let it get a good night's sleep, and then it's back to its normal stuff. So, I mean, I love telling people about this because to me it's like iconic science. I have a question. It's a really stupid question, but then I have to think of an experiment. How would you even design an experiment to do that? And then they're very simple experiments. I mean, a high schooler, middle schooler could figure this out. And then, you know, and the fact that this happened in 2017, this is only a year ago, there's still lots of stuff to learn. We are far from done.
I also loved the excitement that was on you when you were talking about that, and I hope it's able to be heard by the listeners. Finally, Siberian nematodes.
Last year, July, this is Russian University and Princeton University. So permafrost in Siberia. They dug up these nematodes, which are kind of worms, okay? And they're from about 30, 40,000 years ago in the ice layers. They brought them back into the lab, and they thawed them out. They wanted to see what they, you know, how this looked and whatnot. So they had about 300 of them, and two of them started moving and eating. They have been frozen in suspended animation for 30 to 40,000 years, and suddenly they start moving. Now, this is like, I mean, just blows your mind. A, how are they still alive? So scientists still need to do all this, make certain it's not contaminated sample and all this stuff. But now imagine you're the poor grad students. Like, you remember the sea monkeys as a kid? Well, now you've got these 30, 40,000-year-old nematodes. Don't kill them. You know, how do you figure out how to take care of a 40,000-year-old nematode? Okay, so just absolutely fascinating stuff to sit and think about.
That wraps up today's conversation on Steamcast. I'd like to thank once again Dr. Brian Twysocki and Nathan McDonald for joining us all here today. Steamcast is a production of the Project Fibonacci Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to introduce our youth to a culture of interdisciplinary STEAM learning, teaching them to become creative, independent leaders of community resurgence. You can learn more by going to projectfibonacci.org. Steamcast was written, produced, and hosted by me, Dan Kostelic. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Kostelic. Technical support is by Andrew Berger. The music on the show is by The Live and Breathe from the album REIT. You can find it on iTunes or wherever you listen to music. Please subscribe and rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. On Facebook, we can be found at facebook.com/Project Fibonacci. On Twitter, we are at ProFibonacci. That's ProFibonacci. Thanks for listening, and keep moving forward, full steam ahead.